a verse from 1 Peter, which I suspect for a lot of church leaders is their favorite verse in the Bible. Behold, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, that you may declare the wonderful deeds of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Once you were no people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. A chosen race, a royal priesthood, God's own people. He's really talking about a way of understanding ourselves as a church. But what's interesting to me is that there are a lot of different types of chosen people. Chosen for reasons that are sometimes hard to fully understand or even express because we're so different. How do we know that as a church or as a group or as a community, we are God's chosen? Well, there are some religious communities or even educational communities that really do know and claim it to be so. We're driving down to Waco on Friday, and I'm going to be presenting some research that I'm going to talk about here in a minute to the sociology department at Baylor University. And they were kind enough to let us use some of their students as respondents and wanted to know what we found. I also learned when I was down there collecting the data that the people at Baylor sometimes refer to themselves as Jerusalem on the Brazos. I didn't know that. They do. They know that they are a chosen people, a holy nation. They get it. I was also told when we were preparing to do this research, because we not only recruited respondents at Baylor, we have respondents at Texas Tech and also at Purdue University, and the fourth school in our study is the University of Notre Dame, which also considers itself to be a chosen race, a holy nation, God's own people under the Golden Dome. One of the more interesting little moments in the course of this whole project, it's been going on for a couple years, was the chair of the department at Baylor told me that as you seek permission to do this, and if you run into any administrative blocking from us here at Baylor, you need to tell them that you're also doing this at Notre Dame, and the doors will open. Because they're competitors in the chosen people race. They both consider themselves to be the premier religious university in the United States. Of course, they don't talk much to the people in Salt Lake City and Brigham Young, because they also are in the mix here, but that's getting to be beside the point. The point here is, what is it that constitutes a chosen people, a holy nation? A calling to be that in a particular place. And how does what we learn from students in those schools help us understand ourselves, perhaps, in a new way? That's what I want to talk about today. And in order to do that, I want to give you just a little bit of what we have found, because we're starting to put out some of the preliminary results of surveying students at these four schools, Baylor, Notre Dame, Purdue, and Texas Tech, on their level of religiousness, on their level of fundamentalist beliefs, on their deviant behavior, and also with regard to tattoos and piercing. Well, how religious are these folks? Well, we asked a series of questions and measured religiousness like this. How strong is your religious faith? How often do you pray? How close do you feel to God? And how often do you attend church? We also asked several questions that measured their level of Christian fundamentalism. And without going into a lot of detail, it refers to biblical inerrancy and the issue of not letting the world influence you, that the best education for a Christian child is in Christian school, and so forth. So we have religiousness in general, we have Christian fundamentalism as a particular kind of religious belief, and we also have the place where these beliefs show up. Jerusalem on the Brazos, under the Golden Dome, the Panhandle of Texas, and halfway between Chicago and Indianapolis. Well, how much of these behaviors do we see? This is a lengthy presentation, all of which is linked to our church website. There are pretty pictures like this. And without going into a great deal of detail, I can tell you that of the 1,753 students we surveyed, just under 6 in 10 are sexually active, which is actually a little low, because the national average is about 70%. 55% binge drink. Oh, and by the way, 80% of them are underage. Almost 6 in 10 have had 5 or more drinks on one occasion in the last month. So there's a fair amount of drinking going on. Almost 4 in 10 have a body piercing of some sort. And about 15% have a tattoo, about the same amount as use marijuana. That's in the whole sample. I'm going to focus on just a couple of interesting things as we compare the way these behaviors show up in Waco and in South Bend as compared to other places. Moving way ahead here, I don't know if you can see the way these charts play out, but the blue line is Baylor, the burgundy line is Notre Dame, the yellow line is Purdue, and the green line is Texas Tech. And the question here is, what percentage of these students are sexually active, binge drink, or use marijuana? And what I want to point out is this first chart. You see the Baylor kids and the Notre Dame kids at about 40% sexually active, and the Purdue kids and the Texas Tech kids at about 70%? It really does make a difference whether you live under the Golden Dome or on the Brazos or out in the country. And by the way, the tech kids are actually a little bit more than everybody else. And elsewhere in the presentation, the level of fundamentalist beliefs among students at Texas Tech and among students at Baylor, about the same. So it's not belief, it's where you believe it. And Notre Dame and Baylor are right at the same level on this issue. The next one's drinking, and we have the singular influence of the Baylor environment. Only one in three Baylor students say they binge drink. Now, we've been critiqued that they're lying through their teeth. They really aren't. We've checked that out, and there's no reason for them to lie. And we had this symmetry between Baylor and Notre Dame students on the sex question. Notre Dame actually leads on the drinking question, which we think is kind of amusing, because these are very strongly constituted religious environments. They're just very different. Different chosen people in a different place. And the Notre Dame, Purdue, and Tech students are all at about the same level. About 2 out of 3 of them binge drink. About 1 out of 3 Baylor students binge drink. And on the marijuana question, once again, the symmetry between Notre Dame and Baylor and everybody else, although not as pronounced. About 10% of the Baylor and Notre Dame students have used marijuana in the last month, and about 17% of the Tech and Purdue students. So there's a difference, and in this instance, church and state do seem to matter. Well, the point of all of this is that where you are and with whom you live, and even more importantly, with whom you express your religion, with whom you express and have reinforced your religious beliefs, that's what changes the behavior. It's not just what the beliefs are, because belief does not evolve or express themselves in a vacuum. And Baylor and Notre Dame are very similar in some respects, both of which are very different than Purdue and Texas Tech in some respects. And Baylor and Notre Dame are very different from each other in other respects. The question is not who's right or who's wrong, but are those groups in the place where they are doing what God expects or wants of them to do? Well, it's hard to say just based on this data, but they will tell you that they're trying awfully hard to be who they believe they're called to be, which then raises the question for us. What is it that this group in this place, this chosen race, holy nation, God's own people at the Presbyterian Church in Post, Texas, what's our deal? Well, in part, I raised it last week, talking about the results in our church of Jesus' resurrection, that it creates in us at least the opportunity for, and this is not a quiz, tolerance, empathy, and hope. And to that I would add humor. Because in the 13 or so years that I've basically stood and watched this group be who God calls them to be in this place, I've seen a great deal of what is occasionally surprising levels of tolerance of both in each other and sometimes the behavior of each other that really does hurt. I've seen on a Sunday morning people who I know in the course of that week have been at odds with each other very strongly and seriously about issues that confront our community, and yet sit quite nearly side by side, worshiping at the same time and sharing the message of hope and peace that we hope works itself out in what we do. There's an extraordinary amount of empathy in this church, and I've seen a lot more of that just in the last couple of years. We have together experienced enormous struggle and pain over the individual things that have happened to some of our families. We've also shared enormous joy at watching our kids grow up and graduate and get graduate degrees, give birth to children, share in the goodness of love and life, and also experience devastating and sudden loss. And in the midst of it all, we have learned from each other to bear the pain and share the joy. Because we've been there before. The longer I'm here and the more stories I've heard lead me to conclude that it is the strength of what people have been through together that calls forth and shines the light of love in this place. Not a half-bad definition of what love is, by the way. Love is what you have been through together. And there have been enormously difficult and enormously wonderful things that people sitting here and people that join us in regular weekly worship have been through together. And the end of that, the end result of that, is love. We are also just a riot to watch. This is some of the most good-humored church people I've ever met. You know, and out in the Midwest, especially among Lutherans and Presbyterians, the kind of frozen, chosen, grim, and humorless worship life is sometimes more common than I would like, but that's just me. I like people who are willing to laugh with one another. And I got to tell you, Mike Mitchell is just a hoot and a half. He's like one day out of surgery for a really difficult problem for which he was inches away from losing his leg. And yesterday morning he says, they took away my phone and I got some ranch business I want to do. Then the dietitian came in and asked him if he was practicing a heart-healthy diet regularly at home. He said, is whiskey heart-healthy? You should know that this empathy, tolerance, and humor that characterize, I think, our church does not necessarily reduce the binge drinking level. She asked him what he wanted for dinner, and together we came up with brisket and beer. I don't think he's going to get that. But he is who he is. And the struggle of a very lengthy period of time of dealing with poor circulation in his legs that has taken him from the golf course, which is a big loss, hasn't robbed him of his sense of humor. And that I think is constitutive of who we are all together, and more importantly, what we are called to be in this place. Because when you add it up, this particular chosen people, this particular royal nation, doing what we do in this town and in this church, through tolerance, empathy, humor, ultimately leaves us with hope. Leaves us at the end of the day feeling more hopeful than hurt, feeling more helpful than not, and taking us forward into the week such that we know we'll come back together again and have a laugh, share a prayer, maybe stifle a tear or not, But in this place, we are chosen to share what is the sum of all feelings, and that is the love as we experience it, and the love as we have the wit and the will to share it. We not only persevere and adapt and improvise, we laugh and love, and are left with, at the end of the day, always the promise of hope. And for that I'm grateful, and for that the reality of the God who loves us all is ever more apparent to me in this place as we experience it together. Amen.